The Spirit of Jazz podcast, where music dances with mystery, with your hosts, Bill Carter and Jeff Kellum.
This is The Spirit of Jazz, indeed. I'm Jeff Kellum, and Bill Carter's here.
Hello. Good to have you with us today.
You know, Bill, I was thinking about the musicians that I know, and whether it's bluegrass or jazz or classical, almost every musician has had a mentor. You've had more than one, but certainly among those mentors musically, you want to tell us about one very special one for you.
Well, that would be Al Hamm, saxophonist, college professor, dear friend, who passed away recently. So today is a bit of a memorial to Albert.
You had a long relationship with him, and his saxophone and his flute find their way into a lot of your music on the various albums you've recorded.
That's right.
When did you first meet him? Was it college?
I auditioned for the Binghamton University Jazz Band in the fall of 1978. And he put on a play-along recording from produced by Jamie Abersold and said, play along, let's hear how you solo. And I'll never forget it. It was the Miles Davis tune, Tune Up. And I got through it. And when I was done, he said, okay, I've got a seat for you in the band. I've got three piano players and you're the third one.
Yeah.
And that's how I began to connect with other musicians in my university. I was acquainted with him before that because of his reputation around town, but he had also done an adjudication sheet, a scoring sheet, when I took a jazz quintet to a state competition in high school. I didn't meet him. He wrote the score sheet and said, the piano player has promise.
Have you got a couple of college stories with Al?
I've got plenty. Yeah, I've been telling people since his passing that for 45 years, I was his student. And for 43 years, I was his musical companion. One of the college stories, and he used to laugh about this, I was the very first student who ever hired him to play in a band. I liked the sound of his sax. He was the only one around that I knew who could play that well. Frankly, I had gotten to the point where we weren't peers, and not quite yet, but I could write things that would challenge him. And he could make them sound really good.
Excuse me, but was this during college or right after school?
This was actually in my third year of college.
Oh, okay.
I booked him. We had a little campus pub back in those days. College campuses had bars on them run by the university. I think I got him for $75 a night and a couple of friends. And we went in there and just played. It was fun. Something like 7 to 10 or 8 to 11.
That's cool. He didn't have to audition then for that gig, did he?
No, but he'd often come in coat and tie directly from a rehearsal or a class. So the other great story is that in my senior year, in the spring of 1982, they arranged a tour of the jazz ensemble, the big band for the university, and sent us down to Puerto Rico during spring break. Al did not come. He was the chair of the music department. He sent us down there completely unsupervised.
No faculty supervision, no chaperones.
We had Mike Holliber, who was a graduate student, directing the band in his absence. And Sherry Maracle, the great drummer, was in the band at the time, a bunch of others. And most of the band members were not music majors. They were chemistry majors or pre-law, or like me, a philosophy major. And Binghamton did not have a large jazz program, except as Al had created it, and then it grew and grew and grew. So we get down to Puerto Rico, and we come back, and Mike Holliber and I and another guy go out to the parking lot of Kennedy Airport, and we had the responsibility of driving back a state university van, and we couldn't find the keys. And Mike and I look at one another. We don't know what to do. Well, the other guy, I think he was a trombonist, knew what to do. He went in, got a wire coat hanger, unlocked the door, and knew how to jumpstart the van, which we couldn't turn off. So, and we drove 3.5 hours back upstate. And then I wrote a tune called I Lost My Keys in Kennedy Airport, which Al has recorded with us and played many, many times.
I've heard you play it in concert.
Yeah, no keyboard, no keys. So you know, and Al just got a giggle from that. So he's the luminous figure in my soul, my memory, and certainly my musical development.
Not only in yours, but you mentioned Sherry Miracle.
Oh, yeah.
Dino DeRose. I mean, Al's had influence on a number of musicians who...
Yeah, that's right. I was talking with Tony Marino, the bass player, and he said, you know, Al created quite a scene in a small city upstate New York where you would never imagine there was as much jazz going on. And I said, it was all because of Albert. He has gotten a star on a Walk of Fame. He has gotten another star on a Hall of Fame. When the area built an arena and they started bringing in ice shows and circuses, the contractors were looking for musicians. And Al then created a big band that met on Monday nights playing very challenging music to get the local musicians up to the point that the contractors would want to hire them for the shows. After a few years of that, people were saying, oh, man, we got a book in Binghamton, New York, because those guys can really play. Wow. It was all Al.
You mentioned the star on the Hall of Fame or the Walk of Fame. There's also a mural in downtown Johnson City, New York, near the local jazz venue that shows Al Hamm on the side of a building, which is really... But Al was kind of not excited about that outwardly. He was kind of modest about it and kind of poo-pooed it, but I think inside, I think it must have been quite a tribute.
Yeah. Of all the recordings I've done with him, I want our listeners to hear a little bit of his soloing. Al was very much out of the bebop tradition. This is an up-tempo blues I wrote in honor of one of my daughters called Rosie Stomp. And he just plays his roaring solo. First take. Let's give this a listen.
So that's called Rosie Stomp. It's recorded by the Press Bebop Quartet.
That was on the Stand on Your Head album. Al Hamm plays that sax solo. You hear all the essence of it. Great compositional ideas in his solo, a perfect tone. I mean, I used to bust his chops. I'd say, Albert, you didn't play all the right notes. And he'd say, yeah, but I played them in tune.
There's that.
And he'd laugh. I mean, it was remarkable to get that close to a guy like this because he was so competent and so capable. And then late at night, we'd be driving back from a concert somewhere. And, you know, he might confess to all his mistakes that he had made that evening. Had the same kind of self-doubt that a lot of folk did. And yet also the bravado to kind of step out there in front of people.
Yeah.
And the more that I've gotten to know jazz musicians, I realize many of them are really down to earth.
I've been in the car on some Press Bebop tours on a couple of them, and Al, hearing him tell his stories, I've also interviewed him for a local entertainment newspaper. What I remember about him is his early years as a teenager, as a musician, and his relationship with his father. He went out west, I guess, to play at first, and then wound up in Chicago playing in the band for the ABC Radio National Hookup for Don McNeil's Breakfast Club. And Al couldn't have been more than, 19 at the time?
I don't think he graduated from high school. I think he left early, then got his GED later on because he was out on the road. I mean, he told me a story one time that I just cracked up. They were walking down the street, passing a nightclub, and out in the sign, it said John Coltrane tonight. And he said, well, that's pretty cool. So they kind of tried the door and they could hear Coltrane in the back room practicing. And this is like 12 o'clock noon. And he's just playing four octaves up and four octaves down, a B-flat major scale. and then try the permutations and parts of that. They went to hear him that night, and Al said, you know, he kind of blew my wig off. He was just playing so much music. And then they took a break, and within a minute or two, they could hear Coltrane in the back room still practicing again, playing a B-flat major scale. And that constant kind of attention to developing the craft. You know, when we talk about a mentor is somebody who gives us some information, but they kind of stand by the shoulder and call forth what they think you might be able to try or could do. Never forget, Al calls me and gets me in my dormitory room, and I go down. He said, I need some music for a commercial. I said, a commercial? He said, yeah, the Raymond Corporation. They make forklifts up in Green, New York. And I said, what? He said, yeah, they want a short piece. And he says, you write it. And I said, you want me to write it? He said, write a couple things, and we'll pick between them, and I'll take them up. So I had the keys to his studio as a college senior. So I went in one night, locked the door, and just started cranking out a number of things, recorded them, played them on his Steinway. And then they picked one of them. And then he took the music I composed, arranged it for like an 8 or 10 piece band, and we produced this little kind of in-house commercial music. And he gave me $1,000, which, you know, in that day as a college student was like, wow.
Yeah, you bet.
I can buy a house with this. Of course I didn't.
Right, right. That's not made it onto any Presby Bop albums that I remember.
No. No, it's just a little boogaloo thing in D minor. But we had those kind of conversations and variations back and forth. When I bottomed out as a pre-med student, which is not known to many people on the podcast, you know, back in those days, your parents expected you to get out in 4 years. So I took a summer school class or two, but I also went to Al, walked across campus. He said, I'll tell you what, do an independent study, write me 3 big band arrangements, and I'll give you 4 credits as an independent study in music.
Wow.
And to support me, short time after that, he says, come on down to my office at Tuesday at 2:00. So I skipped class and went down to his office at Tuesday at 2:00. And he introduced me to the great arranger Don Sobeski,
wow,
who reviewed my arrangements with me, suggested things, encouraged me, said, you've got a lot of great ideas here. Why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? Vastly improved the arrangements and did it for free.
Terrific.
And, you know, Al just provided opportunities like that. And looking back, when I graduated and went off to seminary in New Jersey, I really did kind of cut all ties. I thought I was leaving him and music behind. But then 7, 8 years, 9 years later, 10 years, whatever it was, it bubbled back. We reconnected, and then we created the Presby Bop Quartet.
Yeah, I was going to say, Al was a founding member of the Presby Bop Quartet and stayed with the group right up until...
Just a few years ago, he decided to retire.
So his sound, his saxophone is on many of your recordings, most of your recordings.
Mm-hmm. Here's a piece that I wrote actually to honor my grandmother, the one who gave me the Dave Brubeck albums. And it's a new melody based on the tune, Someday My Prince Will Come. And her nickname was Ebo. So this is Ebo's waltz. And Al understood this one. He understood classic jazz harmony, and he just plays great. So this is a little bit of Ebo's waltz.
Music from the Presby Bop Quartet and Ebo's Waltz, written as a remembrance or a tribute to Bill's grandmother, whom you called Ebo, and Al Hamm featured on saxophone.
Right.
let me just tell you that I met Al long before you did.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, I was, I guess, a junior or senior in high school, and Al was in his first teaching job. And he happened to be the band teacher. He wasn't the marching band, concert band conductor. He did the jazz band. Okay. And I remember walking by the rehearsal room once at the high school, and there was Al Hamm, thin, tall, full head of hair at that time. The sound that was coming out of that room from some of my classmates was wonderful, because I liked jazz in high school, as opposed to some of my classmates who were more into the emerging rock and roll era. And I guess, you know, I took his picture for the high school yearbook. I don't know that we spoke. I guess probably when I entered the classroom, he must have nodded to me or invited me in, given me permission. Then years go by, Bill, and I go to the Jazz in the Church Conference.
Well, the Jazz in the Church Conference was the first exploration of the relationship between the two.
Yeah. It was at a Presbyterian Conference Center in Stony Point, New York. Al was playing with the band. The band was there, and I guess you introduced the band and said, here's Al Hamm, who hails from Binghamton, New York. And I thought, my gosh, that's close to my hometown.
The same guy. Yeah.
Dawned on me that that's who that was. So I went up to him with my mouth agape and said, you must be the Al Hamm that I knew in high school. Mm-hmm. So from that point on, of course, with my relationship to you and Presby Bop and Al, it's this wonderful, warm man.
Yeah.
He knew how to dress. That guy knew how to dress.
Oh, yes, he did. Yeah. You know, when we go on tour, and he always was driving the Toyota van and in coat and slacks and impeccable shoes, well polished. And I'd be in blue jeans and a t-shirt and sneakers and look like a slob. And that was the way it was. But he was just warm and generous in so many ways, although that was not my initial experience of him. He was exacting. He was demanding. You know, we used to cower sometime when at the university jazz band, we'd have a dress rehearsal, and all these non-major musicians hadn't really practiced. And he would come in and he'd have a meltdown. He'd yell, he'd scream, he'd stomp, he'd throw down his baton, he'd stomp off the stage, count to 30, then come back and say, okay, let's try it again. And I asked him about that years later. I said, so what was that about?
Little theater?
Yeah, well, yeah. And he said, you always sounded better after I did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was psychology. It was a way of kind of standing at her shoulder and pulling out what he knew we could do.
Well, Al was always, he always had an opinion.
Yeah, you think?
I know how difficult it must have been for him to go to concerts and jazz performances. Yeah. And keep it all to himself, because he knew music, and he knew jazz, he knew improvisation, he knew all the ins and outs.
Well, that's right. And for all of our recordings, except for the most recent couple, he was at the booth with the engineer, telling the engineer what to do, deciding what take we're going to use, what needed to be edited, there needed to be more cymbal in this piece, things like that. Great, great ears. He could hear things that nobody else could hear. Just a remarkable, remarkable soul.
Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but what kept him in the area? He was the local impresario when it came to jazz in this upstate New York community. Not only the Shore Family Firehouse stage, which is now kind of the jazz venue, but before that was another club in the area.
A number of places. What kept him there initially was his job, university job. And what also kept him, I think, were the relationships that he built. You know, he'd be 3-4 hours out of Manhattan, and it was nothing for him to drive down and hear somebody in a club and then come back late at night. He had friends down there. He played for years with Slam Stewart, the great swing bass player. And like I've said before, Sherry Miracle and a lot of other great folk. And whenever one of his students would be playing somewhere, he would make an effort to get to hear them. But I think what kept him was also kind of a sense of who he was and where he was rooted, and that it would be kind of foolish to try to go bigger when he was right where he needed to be. you know, like Icarus flying too close to the sun and melting the wax wings.
The other thing that I remember from Al's story is the number of important jazz figures who came to this local area to work with workshops and for not only the college students, university students, but also in high school.
That's right. That's right. Clark Terry, Frank West, Manny Album, the great composer and arranger. Just one person after another.
One of your albums, Dave Liebman, the jazz master,
right,
came in to play on a couple of cuts. And I remember Al watching Liebman play. And later, Al had some very positive comments to say about what it meant to be in the room with Liebman. Yeah. But, you know, Al could have stood on his own, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I think as we wrap this up, I want to reach into our archives and pull out a tune as a lament, and it features him. It's from the Psalms Without Words album. This is a tune called Heart Sick, just to express some of my grief, maybe the grief of others, at the passing of a wonderful musician who's taught us so much and loved us so well. So this is Heart Sick. Thank you.
So that's from the 2-CD set album called Psalms Without Words, and it's Heart Sick, which expresses the sorrow over the loss of the wonderful Albert Helm.
That's right. So, you know, we kind of hold these emotions together, the sorrow as well as the joy, the loss, but also, I have to tell you, the gratitude. He has given so much to me and to so many. And we commend him to the symphony of eternity.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is a production of Presby Bop Music. To find out more about Presby Bop, our music, concerts, and recordings, please explore our website at www.presbybop.com. And send us a note telling us what you think about the Spirit of Jazz. We'd love to hear from you. Check in with us again next time. I'm Jeff Kellum.
And I'm Bill Carter. Thanks for tuning in.